The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 28th of February, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer at Nkandezi Energy. NCCL is ticker there. And Hanno gives an update on the joint development agreement for their integrated 300 megawatt power and coal mine project in Mozambique. Also on the podcast, Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. Dish is the ticker, and Aidan provides an update on his 2019 strategy in relation to its technology and its business operations. I also have Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, talks about bigger companies with news out, including Metro Bank, British American Tobacco, Rolls-Royce, Merlin Entertainment, Marks & Spencer, and Ocado. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. And you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk with a whole load of other content. In fact, there's an article there on Big Dish. There's the SP Angel Morning View, talking about Palladium. There's also an interview with Cliff from Tech Capital. Video there, you can see that. Plus, whole load of other stuff there at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Hanno Pengilly, Chief Development Officer at Nkandezi Energy. NCCL is the ticker there. Hanno, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
It's nearly March, but I don't think we've spoken in the new year, have we?
I can't remember offhand, but certainly a lot has gone on since then.
Yeah, time has slipped by. Nearly in March already, and like I said, it's 2019. Lots of things going on. You've been very busy. You've had some news at the day on the JDA Joint Development Agreement update, so we'll get into that in a bit. As always, though, Hanno, if someone's tuned in, and let's say it's 2019, they decide to start investing, and they're listening to podcasts, and they're listening to this, and they've never heard of you, describe what Nkandezi is all about, please.
Sure. Nkandezi is an advanced stage power development project with an integrated coal mine located in the northern province of Mozambique, looking to generate about 300 megawatts to deliver onto the Mozambican grid, and currently in advanced negotiations with General Electric and China Machinery Engineering Corporation to acquire 60% of the project.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, now that's the sort of central theme of this update here, so the JDA update. Can you take us through what's in it, if you could, please, Hanno?
Sure. I mean, today is a very positive RNS. It's sort of the culmination of a lot of work over the last, I guess you could say, about 8 to 10 months. And what it really is it's to sum it up, it's a message that our partners, General Electric and China Machinery Engineering Corp, or CMEC, have confirmed now that they have the necessary information support from government to progress to binding agreements on the transaction to acquire 60% of the integrated power plant and mine. And that's really the Joint Development Agreement, or JDA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, as I say, very important in that this is the main milestone to achieve to de-risk the project. You know, these are very large capex projects. You're talking about $1 billion with the Nkandezi project. And, you know, a big question with projects of this nature is, you know, where are you going to raise the capital to develop such a project? Who's going to operate it? And, you know, we're looking to address that answer by bringing in two of the world's largest power utilities who have track record in financing, constructing and operating a project of this nature. And in fact, are doing that exactly as partners in a project in Pakistan as we speak. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, a major milestone. It sort of puts us now in the position where the company's focus can turn 100% to finalizing the JDA. Historically, we've had to get through a number of other key milestones to get to this point. Basically, it was a number of things to confirm, I think, the commercial and economic attractiveness of the project, as well as to establish that the project had, you know, besides being economically feasible and attractive, but also, you know, also being able to demonstrate to our partners that this project was supported, you know, is supported in Mozambique, and has the necessary support to give them comfort to move to the next phase with us.
Yeah.
So as a fairly positive development. Just to confirm, to get to this point, we've had to deliver a number of major milestones. And I think, you know, although we can't disclose too many of the details on those milestones because of the sensitivities around tariff negotiations with government, I think, you know, to take into fact that this process has involved us submitting a new updated power tariff to the state-owned utility EDM. It's involved us to get to that tariff, updating all of the project technical assumptions and financial assumptions, to update a financial model to get a robust tariff output that we could deliver to government and was deliverable using GE and CMEC equipment. And then the final piece was delivering to government and EDM through the liaison committee as sort of a project update with a project update timetable showing when we believe we can deliver the project. And following all of those processes, you know, I think the fact that our partners are now prepared to move forward, I think can give investors some clear guidance and comfort that, you know, the indications are that the project is attractive and moving forward.
Yeah, well, it's exactly. It's confirmation that things are on track. And, you know, when you're dealing with other companies, third parties, a government, especially with two big companies like this and a government, you know, there can be stalls and delays along the way. But, I suppose it does reassure investors that, you know, it's all on track. Now, in a previous RNS, you talked about getting approval for a timetable from the government. Have you received this timetable yet, Hannah?
Yeah, so look, this was the last milestone to get General Electric and CMEC comfortable to move forward. And what it was both General Electric and CMEC want to know, they want comfort on when government is going to look to procure the project. They obviously don't want to commit to a project which is going to only happen 10 years out. You know, they can allocate their resources better elsewhere if that was the case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had the meetings with the liaison committee, which was, you know, basically a committee set up by the Minister of Energy, chaired by the Ministry of Energy, and, you know, also represented by the utility EDM. And we received, you know, support for that timetable, which is basically looking at having, first power on the grid in 2023, which would require us achieving financial close sometime towards the latter half of next year, which is the major milestone. Financial close is when basically all permitting, government approvals, financing documents, et cetera, all in place. And first drawdown for funding of the for funding of construction of the project can happen. So that timetable has been approved. It fits within government's stated strategy to have coal-fired energy on the grid by 2023. And I think we're very comfortable that, you know, at this point in time, quite comfortably, Nkondezi is the most advanced coal development project in Mozambique and certainly in the region. And we're certainly one of two projects that I would say are at a very advanced stage for the Mozambican government to take seriously to move forward.
Yeah, okay. And going back a few weeks now, there's an RNS you released where you mentioned that with work with one of your main consultants, Synergy, and that there was a mention of you doing work on potential other opportunities in the African power sector. Can you shed some light on that, if Hannah, please?
Yeah, sure. So, look, traditionally, we've always kept an eye open for other opportunities. The Nkondezi company has, you know, what we believe is a very strong power development platform. With a focus in Africa, with significant experience both on our board and in the management team, as well as our share register. You know, we have a large African Development Funding Institution, African Finance Corporation on our register, as well as one of Poland's largest IPPs, Polenergia, on our register. Mm-hmm. And we believe that that platform, you know, has always had the potential to, to diversify into other power development projects. It's obviously been something we've been very sensitive to, though, because we haven't wanted to detract from the main project and progressing the main project. I think, you know, we are currently in a very comfortable position that the project is moving ahead as we would want it to move ahead, and and we have some clear deliverables over the next 3 to 6 months to really unlock value in that project. But, you know, I think to leverage off of this platform to potentially look at other opportunities is something that I think is it's something that that it's wise to do, but obviously has to be done in the right way. We're not in the business of rushing into things. We certainly don't want to add additional pressures and strains to our existing project, but we'd rather be looking at things that would be value accretive to the project, leverage off of the resources and the intellectual capital we have. And I think, you know, a big part of that is to look at something that, you know, diversifies potentially the risks around the Nkondezi project, and that it's a big project. It's a large capex project. It's got a long lead time for certain deliverables, and obviously also in the fossil fuel space, which is a trickier space to finance. So, you know, what I can say is that, you know, we would be looking, we have been looking at potential opportunities. There are some very exciting ones, but we will only really bring those to the market at the point in time where we've done the right work and we're able to comfortably demonstrate that it is value enhancing to shareholders. And I guess, look, the announcement that was made was not necessarily something that we were, you know, information we were ready to divulge to the market at that stage with respect to looking at other projects. It was a little bit premature, but I think it at least gives everyone comfort that, you know, we are looking at potential things, and we're going about it in the right way in terms of making sure that we're doing our due diligence correctly on these things before we make any decisions. And certainly would look forward to updating the market on that if and when we make any traction. But, you know, as I say, some attractive things out there, and hopefully some positive news in the future in parallel to good progress on the main project.
Marvellous stuff. And so what's the next, what's kind of milestones? What's the next bit of news hoping to come out here from the project?
So right now what's happened is after we received support from the liaison committee to move forward with the project and got the sign-off from our partners that they're now happy to progress with the JDA, we currently have a timetable target to complete the JDA at the end of March. It's tight, but, you know, again, we're dealing with a document that's in a fairly advanced form, and we're going to push to try and meet that deadline. But I think what we will probably expect is further guidance on the approved sort of updated timetable on that JDA once we've sort of finalized the process with our partners. There will definitely be an update on that. And then probably further updates as we progress some of the other work streams, such as the EPC and the O&M process. And as I've said, potentially, you know, if we do make any further progress with any potential transactions, we would obviously update the market. But I think key news flow is update on the JDA, exactly, you know, when we've all agreed that we can deliver it. Mm-hmm. And then some updates, you know, probably some further updates on the EPC and the O&M. Right. And most importantly, that's all, I guess, you know, the JDA update, you know, will hopefully be, you know, will be in the next few weeks.
Okay. Well, one final thing, Hanno, for someone listening out there who likes the sound of the progress you're making here but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
So Nkondezi is one of the most advanced coal power development projects in the Southern African region. We have identified two world-leading utilities in General Electric and China Machinery Engineering Corporation who are looking to take a 60% stake in the project to materially de-risk it in terms of financing, construction, and operation. And finally, we have a binding agreement target timetable at the end of this quarter at the moment, which, you know, would represent a material de-risking of the project. So some material news flow in the not-too-distant future.
Marvellous stuff. Hanno, good to chat to you, and hopefully, like I say, news coming out in the not-too-distant future, so hopefully we'll catch up then. Thanks very much.
Great. Grant. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish at D-I-S-H ticker. Aidan, thanks for joining me.
Great, thank you.
Now you've done a technology and business update, and it's stock has become a hot stock now. It's become well followed. People are liking it. I like the tech. It's a no-brainer. But for people not aware of it yet, Aidan, just give us a quick overview as to what Big Dish is all about, please.
Big Dish is a consumer platform that's providing a last-minute experience for consumers who want to book a restaurant table that has a discount associated with it, up to 50% off the food. So the technical term is we are a yield management platform for restaurants, which basically is all about dynamic pricing, different prices based upon different times for the same product.
Yeah, and it's, like you say, it's been done in the hotel and tourist industry and planes. Because, like I said, there are times if a plane seat is not filled, they're not making any money. It's costing them money to just fly empty seats around, or the same with hotels. So what they do is operate the system where at non-peak hours, you can get better preferential rates, because then it's extra revenue that the companies wouldn't have, isn't it? So, and now that's applying that to restaurants, which makes sense. Why have, empty tables sitting there doing nothing when you could get some revenue from them? It just makes sense, doesn't it? It doesn't cost the consumer anything, and it generates cash for the business owner. So you've gone through...
Absolutely. Empty tables make no money.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you've got the highlights of today's RNS is a new website, technology updates, launching consumer market initiatives, and Southampton expected to go live in March. So let's go through a new website. So I thought this was app-based, but you're going for the website as well, yeah?
Well, we always had a website. So the difference being was in Asia, all bookings were like 99.9% of the app. Nobody uses the website. So we've never really focused on the development of that website. So since coming to the UK, we have discovered that people do like to use a website, not to the same degree as an app. We think it'll grow to about 70-30 in favor of the app versus web bookings, but it did highlight the need. And so we announced to the market around visual changes to the website that would take place to make it more UK centric. We announced that in the middle of January, and that we would do that over a 4 to 6 week period. That 6 weeks ends today, hence the RNS today. And what we determined was it would actually be better just to build a whole new front end website. So we've done that. We've built the whole front end, new front end. And during the month of March, we'll connect that to the back end system, and then it will go live. So this new website, it's fully UK branded and built for scale.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, isn't it, that in Asia they don't even bother with the website, but in the UK we do, just culturally different. Why is that? Any idea?
I think, look, mobile penetration, social media penetration is far higher in Southeast Asia than it is in the UK, I think. And people just, everything is done, not a lot of people even have, PCs, desktops, and that type of thing. Everybody, it's like mobile devices and tablets. So that's why I think it's just easier, and probably because as well, more millennials use the product and use these apps, and they don't want to sit behind a desktop or a laptop. They just want to use the phone or a tablet.
Yeah. Okay. So take us through the other two bits there: technology updates and launching consumer marketing initiatives. What's happening there?
So what that's all about is, so we've, as we, we've been adding our restaurant partners in our various territories. And so now it's time for us really to launch the consumer marketing initiative. So we've got a couple of great marketing agencies coming on board, and what their remit is over the next quarter is really to sort of test a variety of consumer marketing strategies, and the goal of which is to find out what are the most effective channels in the various places we are in. And interestingly enough, what might work well in Bristol might not work the same in Bath, and what might work in Bournemouth might be slightly different to Bristol. So it really requires a to testing what are the best channels, what are the most effective channels that will drive user acquisition and user growth. And so that's the purpose of launching these initiatives.
Excellent stuff. And I can see that you've got there, you're going live in Southampton, which that's the nearest city to me, so that I'll look at that, and I'll use it and see what it's like. So I'll give you some live feedback on the podcast if you want, Aidan.
Hey, that's great. So, we're going. Southampton is going live. That's one of the cities within Territory One. It's great. It's always great to. I saw some people on Twitter post the bill recently at a restaurant they went to with Big Dish, showing the discount they received. So they're all very happy. So yeah, absolutely.
Oh, excellent stuff. So tell us where you are live at the moment, and where you hope to be live over the coming months. Then,
well, what we've said is we've defined. I think it was last in January. We defined the territories and or the towns and cities within Territory One and Two. Yeah. So Bournemouth, Bath, Bristol. We're in. About to go into Southampton. There'll be more to follow. So really, what we're trying to do in Q1 and Q2 is A, reach our restaurant target, which is about 200 in each territory, so 400. At that point in time, you know, our new website, of course, will be ready. That will be built for scale. There's new features. I forgot to mention, we're also going to bring some new features that we announced in the RNS today. One is a new restaurant feature.
Yep.
So that came about as I was watching people, how they use the app and how they discover new restaurants. So we want to make it clearly identifiable within the app and the website, you know, when new restaurants are come on board and join Big Dish. And also we are looking at the review and ratings functions that we're also going to develop. So, you know, we're coming to the point, and Assange said today that one of the things he learned at TripAdvisor was to, you know, the importance of building the business and the tech for scale and for growth. So that's what we're doing. We are building for that, and then there's going to come a time, not too long away, where people will see, right, okay, we are now blitzing it across the UK.
Yeah. I'm just looking. So yeah, tier one. Bournemouth, Southampton,
Territory one.
Bournemouth, Southampton, Portsmouth, Basingstoke, Guildford, Dorchester, and Weymouth, and Territory two is Bristol, Gloucester, Bath, Swindon, Oxford, Windsor, Slough, Exeter, and Plymouth. Marvellous stuff. Now, do you know what? I've heard some people say, well, if this was viable, of course, you're disruptive. And when it's disruptive, you'll have a lot of people saying, this probably won't work. And people said, well, Just Eat, you know, would be doing this if it was viable. It's not the case, is it?
No, I mean, that's sort of kind of, well, yeah, I know people do say that kind of thing, but it sounds logical, but it's not really. So first of all, it is already working. So you know, TripAdvisor have a booking platform that uses, not in the UK, incidentally enough, called The Fork, La Fourchette. That's being used, you know, across Europe and a few other places. Obviously in Asia it's working, not just with us, but also another company that TripAdvisor's booking platform invested into. So the model is working, not just by us, but it is working by others as well. So in terms of, like, you know, we'll Just Eat wake up one day and say, oh, this is brilliant, we're going to go and suddenly do this. I think the answer to that is probably not, because they are sort of laser focused in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've said to people, look, we got a great tech team. We could build an Uber product. Not too difficult to do, necessarily. Doesn't mean we're going to be the next Uber. So, you know, I think it's a case of tech companies tend to stay quite focused in what they're doing, focused on the path they're in. And that's what we're doing. And, you know, that's what probably Just Eat will continue to do as well.
Yeah. So, do you know what? I'm reading Jeff Bezos' biography at the moment, Amazon, of course. And when he started off, he started doing books only. And, of course, there were massive bookstores, superstores in America, like Barnes & Noble was probably the biggest, and they were massive. And people said, well, if this was viable, and this was the internet was kind of new at the time, so they'd be doing it. And if they do start doing it, they'll just wipe the floor with you. And so he had to defend himself against this, you know, accusation so many times, for so many years. And then Barnes & Noble did start doing it. But does anyone actually know now, just Googled Barnes & Noble, they've got their own online website, but Amazon crushed them, you know, absolutely crushed them. And the problem is, it's a different business model. And like you say,
that's right,
to direct people to start doing a different kind of business model doesn't help the business. The strong business itself, it doesn't help. So they found it very hard. They just thought, we'd start doing online, and it didn't take off for them. So like you say, it'd be a lot easier for someone like Just Eat or TripAdvisor or whatever, just come along and take you out rather than try and start from scratch, wouldn't they? Because you will prove the concept and then it becomes successful. And the big companies just take you out, couldn't they?
Well, that tends to be the path within tech. Look, the thing I find great about any disruptive tech is it just sparks a conversation. Sparks a debate. People say, oh, no, you can't do this. Oh, it's never going to happen. They could do this. They could do that. Then you've got people think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And it's great that it sparks a conversation. It sparks a debate. And it's quite enjoyable to watch. But in the meantime, we're just going to keep motoring on. And, you know, we are going to go around the UK. And I think we're very confident about what we're doing.
So in your goals there, over how many months or years do you intend to get up to, what is it, 6,000 restaurants, is it, I think you want?
Well, 6,000 restaurants is a target. We pick that target not out of the sky, but based upon what Taste Card, the old-fashioned dining discount card, do, and they got 6,000 restaurants in the UK. Now, a number of those are big chains, so I think it's important to note we're not going after big chains at the moment. So our goal is independence, the small groups. We want to build up a great selection in every place we go to, and at some point in time in the future, then we can start looking at the larger chains. But we don't want you don't want the platform swamped with one large chain. It would look sort of strange. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. So how long would it take us to get to that? I don't know. I honestly think we could do it in 2 years. I believe we could. It will grow faster and faster and faster, of course, as it starts to accelerate. And at the moment, it's almost like what we're trying to do in creating this platform for scale, in creating this business for growth, is it's almost like a recoiled spring. We're just getting to that point. And at some point in the near future, we will be able to say, right, that's it. We're now ready to blast it across the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, Aidan, well... by the way, one question. You were talking about TripAdvisor there. They have, you say, similar kind of thing in Asia, do they?
So, no, TripAdvisor acquired a platform called La Fourchette, or The Fork, operating in France and some other places in Europe. And, in fact, that's where Sanj Nahar, our CEO, came from.
Okay,
so that's
okay,
how
okay.
And he scaled that from 11,000 or 36,000 restaurants. TripAdvisor's platform also invested into an Asian company doing this model. So the model works. We're not worried about that. I mean, it's pretty clear that it works.
Marvellous stuff. Okay. Right, let's go for the three reasons. If someone's not following the story, give them those three reasons to hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I'll give you the three big dish fundamentals. Number one, people love to eat out. If people love to eat out, they should be following Big Dish. Number two, everybody loves a deal. So if you love a deal, should be following Big Dish. And number three, restaurants don't like empty tables. So if you believe that, dynamic pricing has a future in the restaurant industry, keep an eye on us.
Marvellous stuff. Aidan, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very good, thanks. Very good, yeah. Busy. My goodness, there's 1,001 companies reporting, but apart from that, it's all good.
Yeah, do you know what I did this morning? Well, yesterday, I just broke the rules on everything I tried to adhere to and try and share. And any new investors ever ask me anything, I would say, do a lot of research. You've always got plenty more time. Take your time on investments. Never do punts. They never work out. Not for me. I basically broke all the rules last night. I was looking at Metro Bank.
Do as you do, not as you say, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, most of my portfolio is well-researched. Yesterday, of course, I've been reading about Metro Bank, but I don't know the ins and outs of it. I saw the sort of results they had come out yesterday, and I had a quick punt on them. They were down like 21%. I bought it about 10 quid. I thought that's a good level for support level. It's quite simplistic. and then I started reading around. But this fundraise they've done, 350 million. I thought, hang on, what's the details here in this? And obviously there's accounting problems. There's some kind of loans they messed up with, and so they need that shortfall, that 350 million for the shortfall. And I said, what's the price of this fundraise? What's going on? It's underwritten by several banks, but I couldn't see the price. So it's very vague on the price.
That's
the uncertainty here, isn't it? That's what's pushing the price down, probably.
That, That's absolutely right. I mean, it's a little bit weird because I came out, I think it was Tuesday evening, if I recall, or just after the market had closed, yeah, with this sort of announcement. And yeah, it didn't quantify, it quantified the amount and the banks' names, but not when they were going to do it. And obviously at what price, which is kind of important, right?
Yeah.
You see, the trouble with banks is when it's a confidence game, all banks are confidence games. If we went into any bank in the world, pretty much, and asked for, as depositors, asked for our money back, everybody, pretty much every bank that you could cite would go bust overnight.
Yeah.
So banking is a confidence game. And so when Metro basically said, look, we've bogged it up slightly, you know, we, some of our analysis is incorrect, we're going to need a bit more capital in order to fund our growth in mortgages and other products, yeah, that ain't good, and hence why the shares have come back strongly. And, you know, you can get into other debates about the UK economy and quality of loan book and whatever else, but that's the essence of it in when it comes down to it. So, yeah, I'm surprised by this move, and I'm not surprised, though, that the share's fallen further. You know, I think it's a moot point, though, how far it can fall. My observation is they want to quell this. Yeah. They should do the money raising and get on with it. If it's really underwritten, get on with it. Just do it.
Yeah, because I saw something. That's the problem. That's uncertainty, because, of course, a fundraise is attached to the share price somehow. And if the share price keeps falling, then that's going to go lower. So, you know, normally the fundraise is below the actual market price, isn't it, you know?
Precisely. It's a vicious circle. You know, if the shares, as you say, in the market today, it's just a little bit under £10, you know, you generally would offer a small discount to that in order to get it away, to encourage people to buy the shares. Otherwise, they'd just buy it in the market. So I think maybe some of the volatility, maybe because they're trying to price this thing, and of course, because of everything that's gone on, people are trying to get a bit of a bargain. That's always the way it is. So, yeah, a live and volatile situation, but I think a pretty good MBA case study in a couple of years' time for how not to talk about a money raising, or actually even how not to run a bank in terms of making sure that you've got all the underpinnings and you know precisely from a sort of a regulatory and reporting point of view what you're getting on with. You know, the thing is, Metro Bank, you know, we've all seen them. Maybe some listeners are using them, you know, take their dogs in there and everything else. And it is growing fast.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is, any fool can grow a business fast, you know, but the trick is to make money on it as well. And that's the harder call with this one. Ultimately, what's the quality of the mortgages and the loans and whatever they're making, given that, you know, in order to grow fast, maybe you've got to take on people with slightly different backgrounds and credit histories and whatever. That's to me is the medium term debate. But for God's sake, they've got to get this money raising done, quell this issue, and move on.
Yeah, well, do you know what? So one of the reasons why I looked at it, I thought, hang on, their valuation now has gone below $1 billion. I've seen quite a few of them around. They're in most cities now. And what I quite like is that, yeah, I looked at this, just the growth there. And yes, I think obviously they're overvalued, but you're paying for growth a little bit. I mean, so yes, their underlying profit before tax is up 140%, and underlying earnings up 110%. And they've won the best bank for overall quality of service for personal banking. And I think that goes a long way. So they've watched $120 million from the Capability Innovation Fund, and I think they're making all the right noises, apart from, like I said, that mess up, which is quite serious. So I think the growth is there, and you know, they're not burning cash crazily, they're making a bit of cash. So I thought, do you know what? How many banks do you know that are growing that fast, that are valued under $1 billion?
Mm.
And I just thought, just get that fundraise sorted out, and get the uncertainty out of the way, and I think it may fly. Who knows? It's a punt. Yes. My punts never work out, you know? And,
there you go. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
I say, ultimately, I think it's about the credit quality, but they've got to get the house in order, and the money raising's clearly the first step in doing that.
Yeah, cool. Marvellous. Anything else that was happening, Chris?
Well, lots of stuff's happening. My goodness, I say 1,001 companies reporting. Let's crack into a few of them. You know, tobacco's been sort of a funny old place in the last couple of years, been certainly rotated against by the rise of this sort of more environmentally friendly type investing. Tobacco tends not to be score very well on social governance and related factors for many obvious reasons. That's hit the shares of Imps and Bats, among others, around the world. Bats have come up with their numbers today. Hadn't been taken that well, actually. Shares back in the down to and change percent as I speak, 27 and something pounds. But the numbers were all right. I mean, the thing with this company is a lot of people hold it for the dividend. And, you know, I always talk about the importance of holding shares for many reasons. And you know, dividend is a reasonable reason to hold a share, but you want a bit of growth on it as well. And if you look at Bats today, it does have a bit of that. You know, there is a bit of growth there. They've talked about high single-digit growth for 2019, which doesn't sound too bad. And obviously, the dividend yield is you know, it's quite striking. They're still pushing up. It went up a few percent in 2018 and, you know, is happily in the 6% plus arena today. So I think with Bats, just like with Imps, the shares do look, frankly, good value. What you've just got to be careful of is if not just people not investing in this space anymore, because I think ultimately the shares have come down enough where there'll be enough value investors happy to pick them up. It's just whether you get kind of changes in fashion and style, and obviously big things like the shift away from cigarettes to new style, newfangled e-cigarettes and vaping and everything else. Bats are in the vanguard of that. They've got some good products, but obviously people worry a bit that it opens up some new regulatory issues. Frankly, I think people like BAT and Imperial Brands, they're well experienced in dealing with this stuff. So actually, my personal view would be the sector is a buy here. And, you know, you look at the Bats share price chart, nice support to 25 quid, but frankly, in my opinion, below the £30 level on a bad day, which I guess is a negative day for the shares like today, I'd be accumulating this one here from a sort of a total return perspective. Good div and a good some continuing growth potential.
Yeah, well, and do you say they're quite strong on the dividend, aren't they? They're always it's one of those stocks that people buy the dividend, aren't they?
That's right. Well, you know, you get an over 6% dividend yield at the moment, and they noted in today's update that they raised the full year 2018 dividend by 4%. Obviously, that's a guide to their relative level of confidence. Sure, they've taken on some debt, they've done some deals recently, but all that's done is improve their position in key markets and also with new star products as well. So you put it all together: cash generation, dividend, longevity of brand. Yes, you know, we come into sort of the moral discussion of tobacco and tobacco investing. You put that to one side, I think as a pure investment, I would be accumulating the stock here. Although at the margin, I would probably slightly prefer Imperial Brands on the basis that it's a bit smaller. It's probably more likely to be involved in industry consolidation if there is any, and it's a touch cheaper.
Mm. Marvellous stuff, BATS, marvellous. What's next, Chris?
Well, gotta have a quick one on Rolls-Royce. Now, Rolls-Royce is not the cars. It's Rolls-Royce, the sort of engine maker and military supplier and things like that. It's thematically, you know, there are fewer stocks in the FTSE 100 as strong as Rolls-Royce, because you think about things like engines, you know, that's a real high capex technical area. And, you know, you put your engine in a jumbo jet or something, and all of the servicing and related matters that go into that over a, you know, a 20, 30 year period, very, very exciting. You look at a company like Rolls-Royce, though, with in theory wonderful recurring revenues over time. So, you know, a very nice thematically strong business, but one which has had a few problems over recent years, been a couple of scandals. There's been some shabby cash flow generation. They evolved the management in order to try to tackle these things. And I look at today's numbers, and it's got a bit of all of that still in there. They're still kind of working through that period. Obviously, the company's now run by the ex-head of Arm, like a Warren East, who did a great job at Arm, but seems to be stabilising the ship, if I'm not mixing my metaphors, at Rolls-Royce. The thing is, though, is that he's doing all the right stuff. The cash flow comments are great. They're talking about hitting this big cash flow target next year, which is absolutely fantastic. They've got a few issues, though, and they've pulled out of certainly one of the Boeing contracts because they're still sorting out some technical issues and stuff like that. So there's good and there's bad in today's data. But here's my observation. People buy this one because of where it might be tomorrow. As I said, that really big installed base of engines and the profits and service profits from it. So here's my problem with it, and here's how I've traded it over the last, actually, few years, to be brutally honest. And it's funny you mention sort of the round number levels earlier, Justin, with Metro Bank, you know, £1 billion and all of that sort of thing. Because I think round numbers really matter with investors. You know, we just talked about a couple of them with BATs. You know, with Rolls Royce, £10 a share has been a huge level for them. And, you know, on both the upside and the downside, they keep on coming back to it. And to be honest, you know, the shares are down today. They're down 4% today. Where are they falling off from? Basically £10 a share. And, you know, that's a real kind of support resistance point. So my feeling is Rolls ultimately is a share that's worth something above £10. But all we need to do is wait for a big enough discount to that level. And my guess is that's probably something with the share price beginning with an 8. So one to watch, one to really love. You know, we talked about thematic shares a couple of weeks ago. You know, thematically in a great position. You buy it with an 8 in front of it, I would say Rolls-Royce is a good long-term hold.
Yeah, okay. All right, marvellous stuff. What's next, Chris? Who's reporting next?
Quick one on Merlin Entertainment. Now, you know, who doesn't love going to Legoland? I mean, I know secretly, Justin, you've been there about 1,000 times. But
well, do you know what? I managed to get to one of those. They had these passes for the entire parks. And when I used to work at a radio station, I mentioned Legoland because we'd been there. And the guy just said, do you fancy a pass? So I worked there for the entire, you know, group. I said, of course I do. So we had it. Yeah, not just for me, of course. I've got kids. And that'd be a bit odd if I just had it for myself. But, so we had a family pass there. And we went over. The one thing, I mean, they got a lot more things than you realise. But Legoland, we found, was one of the biggest queues ever. It's ridiculous in Legoland, you know. But, you know, I can see the attraction, you know.
Quite literally, you know, what an attraction. You look at, actually, I was looking earlier at their range of things that they are just open. They opened in 2018. Get this. Legoland in variety of locations, UK and America. Various things with sort of things in Shanghai. Bear Grylls things again in the States and the UK, Peppa Pig World of Play in Shanghai, etc. All these great brands, all these great locations, they should be coining it in. But the numbers today are surprisingly dull. You know, yes, everything's moving broadly in the right direction, but, you know, number of visitors to their theme parks up 1.4%, revenue up 5%, operating profit up 1.3%. It's a bit dull, and it's not as if you can blame the weather, because the weather was scorching last summer in much of the Northern Hemisphere, and heads have been kind of good for them. So it's a bit of a funny one. They are working very hard to keep pushing forward, spending a lot of money on new parks and everything, and that should be good longer term. But I'm not seeing the cash flow today, and the debt actually went slightly up in 2018. So put it all together, I'm not, you know, the shares in sort of in recent, the last sort of 18 months or so, have been in sort of a broad 300 to 400 pence range. And it's sort of right in the middle of that at the moment. It's up a little bit today, but it's in the middle of that at the moment. My feeling is you get it towards the bottom of that range, I like it. I think leisure is a growth theme. I think they've got the right brands, you know, things like Madame Tussauds, Alton Towers, Peppa Pig stuff, Bear Grylls stuff, Legoland. You know, some of these are very global, have real global reach, and, you know, is very good. The trouble is, I just want to see cash flow, because ultimately that's how you value companies. They ain't producing the cash flow. They're spending it on the parks, which might be good, but they can't keep on saying that. At some point they've got to switch that engine off a bit and start rewarding shareholders. So I'd buy the share towards the bottom of that 300 to 400 pence range. Let's call it below 333p or something like that. That's kind of where I've put a little flag or limit. But at the moment I'm just chilling. And maybe the easiest thing for me to do is just to rock up to Legoland with the family and check it out on the ground, a bit of on-the-ground research.
Yeah. And, do you know what? I've never understood Madame Tussauds. I mean, to me, if the real celebrities are standing in there, I wouldn't be queuing for the place. But you get, tourists queuing up, going around there, seeing people like... in fact, I always laugh. I've also seen a picture once in the paper of some Japanese tourists, I think it was, standing next to a Terry Wogan waxworks model. I thought, you don't know who Terry Wogan is. It's like, I mean, there's some photographs with everyone. And I thought, you know, like I said, I wouldn't, if they're real slabs were there, I wouldn't even queue up for them, so let alone waxwork models. But it's a hugely popular. Every time I used to drive past Madame Tussauds, there's queues around the block, you know?
The top tip, if you ever want to go there, book your tickets in advance. Never, ever just rock up there as I did once, just on the fly. It's an absolute nightmare. So, Chamber of Horrors is quite good, but, you know, it probably scares you when you're 8, but somewhat older than 8, it's not quite so scary anymore. But there you go. Good family fun.
Marvellous. And before you go, I just have a quick word on Marks and Spencer's Ocado, what do you think of that?
Yes.
Because, I mean, is it the case that Waitrose is, their contract is up with Waitrose or something, and then so Marks is jumping in there or something, or buying them, or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's, in essence, you know, that is, I think, a big drive for Ocado to have the chance to work with somebody else more deeply. If they, which clearly they're working with a number of people around the world as well. They don't have an exclusive here. But clearly you can only generally really work with one primary partner in any one market. Look, M&S have got to get into the 21st century. This is a way that helps them do that. It's an expensive way to do it. They've had to raise money, 600 million odd quid, in a money raise, which tonked the shares yesterday. They came down from sort of come near 300 pence to, I think, they're about 265 pence at the moment. So, you know, a big hit on the shares because of the money raising. Is it the right thing to do strategically? Does it give them a big boost in this era? Absolutely. For Ocado, on the presentation, they were loving up M&S, saying that actually they're rated even higher than Waitrose on a variety of sort of customer satisfaction things. So you can see the relationship makes some sense. The people that get hurt in the short term are M&S shareholders because you've had to fund it. But is it the right thing for M&S to do? Yes. Do I still think that people, the M&S management, get where they're going? Finally, I think the answer is yes. I think this is a smart thing to do. But as I say, short-term shareholder pain, I'm afraid, is the cost of it. So expect M&S shares to sort of continue the creep back towards 300 pence over the next year. But, you know, it's a long, hard road for the shareholders, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know someone was watching, I was watching Sky Business News, and one of the guys on there, the commentator, criticising it, saying it's not a good deal for M&S. But I just thought, they've got to do something, you know, something different what they've been doing. Because it's been, for years now, it's been dragging down. Even their food sales, not impressive, which used to be very good. It's just been dragging. And you've got to do something radical there, you know?
Yeah, that's it. And it's not cheap. And, you know, a card of extracted terms and whatever else. But they've got to do it. And just like, I think they made a bit of a jump in the last a couple of sets of numbers ago when they said, look, we're actually going to close a lot of stores. This is what M&S has got to do. It can't be on every high street anymore. Online's only going to get bigger and more important. They're good in convenience already. They get much better in online, which they've been a bit shabby on. That's not a bad combo. Let's see what they can do with it. So yeah, I think for both sides, actually, for Ocado, it gives, you know, M&S is a good and established name to work with, and obviously they can work on a lot of other things as well potentially with them, whilst maybe Waitrose, maybe John Lewis partnership wasn't prepared to play ball on everything, just wanted to keep it just a Waitrose. So we'll see.
Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris. As I'm talking, Metrishares opened up the day about 5 cents down. And now they're 5 cents up. So it's, you know, it's an exciting watch. It's like a micro cap. It's like a micro cap at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that tells me though that they must be doing in the midst of the placing, I'd have thought, and they're trying to work out, you know, what level to do it at and stuff like that. We'll see. You know, obviously they'll stick out a regulatory news statement if something important has occurred.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris. And we'll catch up next week.
Sounds good. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, Mobile Streams, that's MOS. At 4, Shield Therapeutics, STX. At 3, Aiden's on the podcast earlier, Big Dish, D-I-S-H. At 2, Realm Therapeutics, R-L-M. And number 1 is Meditech Pharma, or Meditech Pharma, and that's, what is it, M-T-P-H. I think that's the case. Okay. Top 5 most liked RNSs came from the following companies. At 5, Management Resource Solutions, Half Year Report. At 4, Big Dish, Technology and Business Update. At 3, Codal Minerals, Updated JORC Mineral Resource Estimate. At 2, Oriel Resources, IAM Gold commenced 2-year earning at Delfin. And number 1 most liked RNS came from N Condesi Energy. That's the JDA update I talked with Hanno earlier on. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchas gracias.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.